You're listening to Beyond the Jargon, a jargon-free look at graduate students and their research journey here at UVic.
I'm pleased to welcome to the studio as my guest today on Beyond the Jargon, Erin Mills, who is a law student here at UVic, and one of the winners of the 2013 Vanier Scholarship. His research includes exploring how Canadian and Indigenous legal traditions can exist together. Thank you for joining me here today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Maybe I should ask, is that a good explanation of what your research is? I've taken that from the UVic press release.
Yeah.
Does that sum up sort of what you do at least?
Yes. Yeah. It's very close. My project is trying to address what is for me a very serious problem in Canada, a fundamental issue of injustice for Indigenous peoples. And being that, we live, Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples, together today in what is, even in 2013, a state of colonialism. And so one of the key determinants of our relationship with each other is a colonial dynamic. And many, many Indigenous peoples have a vision of what's called treaty federalism. This is very much not my idea, but it's an idea of a way we can live together today based on principles that were agreed to while we were making treaties with one another. And a major obstacle to achieving that vision today, there are many, mm-hmm. but one of them is that non-Indigenous folks often are skeptical about whether Indigenous peoples even had a system of law prior to colonization. Hmm. And then because of processes of colonization, many Indigenous peoples ourselves today are unsure about the details of our own systems of law. Hmm. And in most instances, they're not functioning today in the way that they were when our communities were consistently healthy. So the project is motivated by that worry and wanting to articulate the theory behind one system of Indigenous law, my own, the legal order of the Anishinaabe, or known in Canada also as Ojibwe peoples. Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely not proposing to substantively articulate its content. For a host of reasons that leave me unqualified for that mm-hmm. task, but I am wanting to explain the thinking behind it so mm-hmm. that people both inside and outside of that community can understand it better, and then hopefully the project will be a resource for communities who are interested in giving substantive content to their legal traditions today.
Now, you talked about this uncertainty and not really knowing what, I guess, those traditions of law meant. So is part of that just trying to sort of track down, I guess, what those traditions of law meant? And is that, how difficult is that? And what are your sources? How are you finding that information?
Yes. The sources are many and varied. Mm-hmm. Some textual, so some archival research. And as a discipline, I'm using ethnohistory. But without a doubt, the most important resources are people today who are knowledge carriers, elders, medicine people, who hold pieces of the law and do legal work today. And so using my own existing relationships in my community and nearby communities around Kuchiching First Nation in northwestern Ontario, mm-hmm. Matanchigaming, and then building new relationships along the way, those will be, I think, by far the most important sources, because I need lots of direction mm-hmm. for this project. What was the first part of the?
Oh man, sorry, I threw a whole bunch of questions at you there. I guess you answered that. Yeah, you are trying to sort of determine what that framework might look like, I guess. So how far are you into this research, and have you got a sort of a vague idea of what that framework might look like? Yeah, I'll stop asking all the questions I want to ask right there.
I would say I'm very close to the beginning. Formally, I didn't start until this summer. Mm-hmm. The ideas I've been working with since 2009, actually, I was one of the very lucky students to be part of what was then the pilot project for what will become the JID program at the law school here.
And what is the JID program?
So this will be a a four-year law school commitment, the graduates of which will get two law degrees. One, the traditional JD in Canadian common law, and the other one in various Indigenous legal traditions, which are taught as part of that curriculum. Mm-hmm. And so in the summer of 2009, there was a program consisting of three courses that were taught just to see how well it can work. And mm-hmm. it was a huge success and had a tremendous impact on me and really got me thinking that it's possible to articulate Indigenous systems of law in a way that people outside the community can engage. Mm-hmm. So actually, that program was a really key moment for me, and I've been thinking about Anishinaabe legal order in a very serious way since then. But I was still in my JD, and then I articled, and then I did my master's, and it was just course-based. So this is really my first chance to start hammering through the ideas mm-hmm. in a consistent way.
So how did you wind up in law? What was sort of the path that you took to get to this point in your academic career?
Well, there are two different ways I can answer that question. Mm-hmm. I suppose the totally honest answer is I had actually deferred for a year thinking that I would be a novelist and always motivated to try and achieve as best as I can transformative change in Canada. I grew up being deeply motivated by issues around poverty through political commitments of my mother's and how I grew up, and Indigenous peoples, and those were sort of the two central issues for me. And I thought the best way, my skills being what they are, that I could help would be through works of fiction. And so I thought, and this is embarrassing, that in law school I would... It was a very instrumental approach to a legal education. And so I actually thought that I would acquire means to get enough income in a short enough number of hours mm-hmm. that I could spend most of my time writing, which was, of course, a horrible plan and failed immediately. Uh-huh. Within the first semester, I had totally abandoned that endeavor and focused entirely on justice for Indigenous peoples. It was like that fast.
So the idea was to be part-time law student, part-time novelist.
Yes.
And just became full-time law student.
Immediately.
Was it because of the time commitments, or did you find it was just more enjoyable and more rewarding to be immersed in your legal studies?
I had incredible opportunities in the first year of my law school. Through mentorship, through some resources that were available, and part of it actually is I just got extremely upset and then extremely angry mm-hmm. when I read the core Section 35 Aboriginal rights cases mm-hmm. and the way that our judiciary has approached justice for Indigenous peoples. And I was so frustrated that I sort of spent ever since then trying to think best, what can I do about this? And so it was through my experience at UVic in 2009 mm-hmm. When I realized I don't need to position myself as constantly fighting within that system. Mm-hmm. I can actually, there are ways that I can articulate another vision, another way forward. And so that's really where I'm extremely hopeful. Mm-hmm. And that's what's keeping me motivated now.
Right. Can you explain what, maybe in more detail, the things that actually made you mad about the case studies that you were looking at? And mm-hmm. maybe how you want to change things with this new vision?
Right. Well, there are a whole host of doctrines we could speak about. The Supreme Court has settled on a very, very narrow idea of Indigenous identity. And... they've made themselves arbiters of Indigenous cultures, and that's problematic in so many ways. And so they have ideas around authenticity of Indigenous identity and which traditions, where change is ongoing, as it is for all peoples all the time. This mm-hmm. is just sort of a fact of being. This is nothing unique about Indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. If Indigenous peoples want to grow and actually have rights commensurate with their processes of cultural change, that's actually a really serious problem within Section 35. That's one issue.
When you're talking about Section 35 of what?
Right, sorry. The Constitution Act 1982.
Right, okay.
So it's part of our Constitution. Mm-hmm. It's outside the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, mm-hmm. but it's the section, Part 2, that gives rights to Aboriginal peoples, which are defined as Indian, Métis, and Inuit peoples. Mm-hmm. And also, it gives effect to, or it recognizes existing Aboriginal and treaty rights. So, for rights, Aboriginal or treaty, mm-hmm. that were existing in 1982, mm-hmm. It gives them official constitutional recognition.
Right.
So it's the foundation under Canadian law mm-hmm. for discussions around Aboriginal rights.
And how is this new vision then something, or these ideas that you have, how do you want to change that, I guess, for the better?
Well, from the ground up.
Yeah.
So really it's a structural shift. My project isn't within what's generally talked about as the recognition paradigm. So my proposal is not one that asks Canada to tolerate Indigenous difference somehow. The claim is much more robust than that. It isn't for toleration. It's for partnership. That's the heart of that word I used at the start, treaty federalism. Mm-hmm. That being the case, Indigenous peoples need to be able to articulate their own ideas of what is a good life and the work that law should be doing and the structure of how law works on their own terms. Which is to say, it has to reflect their own worldviews, their own ways of being in the world. Mm-hmm. And the framework of Aboriginal rights is profoundly inadequate to that task. Mm-hmm. It makes a kind of space, but very much within the toleration paradigm of relationship. Mm-hmm. And it insists on an act of translation. And so the kinds of claims that Indigenous peoples will want to make have to be articulated within not just the legal framework, but there's a whole system of thought behind it, going back to the Enlightenment and what it means to be a person even. Mm-hmm. And they have to do that magical act of translation. And so, one, that's profoundly unfair, mm-hmm. but more than that, it does violence to their ways of being in the world. Mm-hmm. And I really feel very strongly they ought not to have to do that.
Is the research, your research here at UVic, is that part of something bigger that's looking at these issues? Are you one person that's just trying to, you know, figure this stuff out and move forward? Or do you have other right. people that yes, are working on right. the same stuff?
Yes. One very small person in a much larger and quickly growing movement. Mm. There are so many others who have been mentors to me and whose work I admire and who I've had the great pleasure of knowing and working with. I'm almost loath to start listing names in case I forget someone, mm-hmm. but many of them are here at UVic, at UBC, Athabasca. One of my first mentors was at U of T. She's gone now to another school. But this is a movement that's really gaining traction. And not just in the academy. There are political actors and legal actors paying attention as well. Until very recently, Chief Justice of British Columbia, Finch, his retirement speech was just amazing. And it was a call. He presented an argument that legal actors in British Columbia have a duty to learn about Indigenous legal systems. And what an amazing statement that was for me, mm-hmm. From a retiring Chief Justice of a Provincial Court of Appeal. So, yes, I'm a very, very small part. And then the other part to answering that question is, of course, this isn't something that's just happening in the academy. Mm-hmm. Indigenous legal traditions are alive today in communities. And so my most important teachers come from there, elders I work with, Bessie Mainville, Fred Major. And that work never stops. Mm-hmm. You know, they're always teaching others and informing my view of how norms work. mm-hmm. in our society. So it's drawing from my community connections and building new ones. And then also this is happening in the academy and it's gaining traction.
Now, you said you were from Northern Ontario, and you're looking specifically at Indigenous law traditions from that area. Yep. But you're studying out in BC. Are you looking at British Columbia or, I guess, Indigenous law traditions out here as well? And does that inform your research at all?
Right. That's a great question. So if I can back up for one moment, I am from Northern Ontario. I'm from Kuchiching First Nation, but I didn't grow up there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to say that because while I definitely belong to that community, I don't belong to it in the same way as folks who have grown up there. So it's really been as an adult that I've been coming back and getting teachings there.
Did you grow up somewhere else in?
Northeastern Ontario.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
yes,
in North Bay mm-hmm. With my mother, mm-hmm. Who's not an Indigenous person. My father is.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so I wanted to say that. Mm-hmm. In terms of Victoria, the reason I'm here is there's nowhere like this law school on the planet. Hmm. I was at Yale for my Master of Laws degree. Mm-hmm. And if I just wanted to sort of be mercenary about it, and if all I cared about was sort of getting a job at the best university I could, then the smart money was to stay there and do my doctoral degree there. But there was nobody there who could offer me half of what I have here. Hmm. I have the most incredible committee, John Boros, Jeremy Weber, and Jim Tully. And they'll take me places that there's no other institution of higher learning, not just in Canada, but in North America or anywhere. And then John, of course, is an Anishinaabe. And so it was very important to me to have someone from that shared community, not just in my own community, Kuchiching and surrounding area, but actually in a formal academic capacity in a supervisory role. Mm-hmm. So that was largely I came here to work with him.
I guess the other second part of my question was about Indigenous law traditions in BC, and are you looking at that, or is it are you just primarily focused on Ontario?
Yes, primarily I'm focused on Anishinaabe law, which mm-hmm. isn't actually just Ontario.
Okay.
We sort of emanate out from the Great Lakes, but there definitely is a lot of strength to be drawn from work on other Indigenous legal orders. Mm-hmm.
Is there much research being done into other areas of North America?
Yes, but UVic is really the center.
Right, yeah.
And it's a movement that, thanks to hard work from John and others over so many years, is really gaining traction now, but most of it is still to come. It's early, I think, in the development of the Indigenous law movement in universities. But there's work that I know from graduate students now or folks who are professors but did their doctoral dissertations on Indigenous peoples' legal systems. Cree, Gixan, Nuchonalth, Coast Salish. I know there are others too, but those mm-hmm. are just off the top of my head.
Now, you mentioned having ties to community and talking to political actors and how these all must be very important to this movement. I mean, if it's completely self-contained in the academy, I feel like it might not affect as much change as if there is communication with other aspects of society. Do you reach out? Do you talk to people? Not just for your own research purposes, but as a movement in itself, is there communication with those other parts of, I guess, society at large?
Right. That's such a huge question. So I think this is presumed in what you said, but the first point I would want to make is the connection to our own communities. So it would be impossible for me to do this work without connecting mm-hmm. with Anishinaabe communities. But you think your question is more about political actors.
And I guess looking for change or systematic change, I guess, is what I'm talking about.
Right. Yes. That, I think it's the only way this can work. My project is very much aspirational. It's not programmatic in the sense that
right.
I'm not offering a roadmap mm-hmm. for actions interested peoples might take over the next 10 years to make things slightly better. I'm offering a vision of how things could be dramatically different in a nonviolent way. And that's really not as much a legal project as it is a political one.
Mm-hmm.
So something like that can only work with dramatic engagement from non-Indigenous citizens. They have to care. They have to. It has to be something that inspires them to want to understand their own citizenship in Canada in mm-hmm. a different way. That's not something, that is not a project that's achievable working strictly within the boundaries of the academy. So I'm not pushing too hard right now. There are folks I've been having those conversations with, and they've been fruitful. But I'm not quite as active as I will become when I'm much further along. There's often, and although I regret this, I think it's understandable, an effort to subsume the ideas I present under available categories. And so it's a kind of accidental colonization of Indigenous legal systems. And so...
Can you explain that a little bit, in a little bit more, what you mean there?
Yes. There's a risk in engaging with political and legal actors now, before I've got my own ideas much more worked out,
mm-hmm.
that they will want to take Indigenous, they'll want to take law from Indigenous legal systems outside of the philosophical tradition in which it is embedded, which gives it meaning and coherence,
mm-hmm.
and to transplant it into Canada's legal system. I have a lot more thinking to do about, and not just thinking ceremony, about that prospect, but I'm deeply worried about it. It's not at all within my vision. In fact, I would be careful about stating this too categorically, but my intuition is to be against that, the sort of transplants model of engagement with Indigenous law. So what I need is to be able to explain the entire theory all at once. And I have pieces of it now.
Mm-hmm.
But when I can do that, then the hope is it will be clear to those folks I want to engage and whose help is necessary for my larger mm-hmm. political ambition ever to be achieved, to understand that that's just not a viable approach. It's not what's going to get there. It's a way to try. I would like to think that folks who take that position are earnestly trying to account for Indigenous difference by liberalizing Indigenous legal orders, by bringing them within what is already understandable, intelligible within Canada's constitutional order.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can't be, that political commitment can't be a starting point
mm-hmm.
for the vision I've just barely sketched for you here. It requires Canada to undergo substantial change as well. So it isn't the case that Canada is being asked just to make minor changes to accommodate Indigenous legal orders. There needs to be a very serious process of national self-reflection where people ask themselves what their citizenship means to them
mm-hmm.
and what are the conditions that sustain it today, and if they're happy about that. And if they aren't, that may mean changes.
Wow, it's huge stuff you're talking about.
Yes.
How optimistic are you? Do you ever get discouraged? I mean, I feel like the it might be difficult to keep the optimism up and the drive to keep doing this kind of work.
I get asked that a lot, actually. No, I feel tremendous hope. I'm so inspired by my peers, by people in my community, by my mentors, John Burroughs, I mentioned my committee members, and there's so many others. Val Napoleon's also here at UVic Law. She's doing wonderful work. And, you know, in lots of communities, things are bad. There are really serious struggles. But, I mean, the narrative we don't often get is the amazing recovery, the stories of hope. There's so many amazing things happening in reserves and other indigenous communities as well. And those stories, for some reason, aren't as sexy in the news. But I see youth claiming their culture with tremendous pride. And that's amazing. Like, that's, how can what I'm talking about ever happen but for that? Sometimes I worry that non-Indigenous Canadians aren't as aware of those stories as they perhaps could be.
I think you're completely right. I worked as a reporter for 4 years, and most, well, in general, a lot of the news I reported was bad news. But but also, yes, there were those stories of triumph coming out of Indigenous communities often. It was often negative stuff. So,
yes. The other thing is, I mean, let me be clear. I don't have any illusions that what I'm talking about is simple or easily accomplished, or I get it. But I'm really nerdy. I'm always writing judges or journalists or politicians, and it's incredible the response I get. So I had an amazing response just over this past year from Bob Ray on an issue. He actually, when he was coming here, made a point of meeting me for breakfast.
Wow.
I mean, I was totally blown away, and it was I was very impressed with a statement he made about I Don't Know More, and so wrote to share my thoughts and to encourage him to sort of, you know, keep on that line. People are listening. And the Chief Justice of Canada, the Right Honorable Beverly McLaughlin, I wrote her, and she actually wrote back.
Wow.
So I find lots of reason. This is not to say that I agree with all these folks on all their positions they take. I don't mean to be saying that, but I mean, I'm a nobody. So if they're willing to engage with me, that I think that really says something.
We're just about out of time. Or tell me how much longer this research right now that you're focusing on will take you, and basically what's next? What are you doing after you've gotten this scholarship now? What happens next?
Right. Well, the most honest answer is my entire life.
Right.
It isn't something that will ever stop. And as much as I accomplish will only ever be a small piece of it. Formally, in terms of my PhD, the plan is 4 years. And what comes next? This year I have coursework. I have a strong start because, like I mentioned, I've been working through some of the ideas since 2009 for the theoretical framework. And so I'll be able to transition into that work very quickly. I go back to my own community every summer. So I'm already looking forward to continuing discussions about Anishinaabe legal order there, and there are already some plans in place, new people to meet and old conversations to continue and push further. That's mostly where my mind is right now, about those conversations. And one of the most important things I've learned through those experiences is actually not to come in having overly structured the questions up front, because often the most important things are things that I wouldn't even know to ask. So a lot of it is just being present. And instead of coming in with an idea of what's important and looking for answers, opening it up much more than that and starting with hearing people tell me what's important and then trying to work with that.
All right. Well, I hope we can have you back. I'm sorry to end the interview here. This is such an interesting topic of research. Thank you for being my guest today on Beyond the Jargon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, thank you for listening to Beyond the Jargon on CFUV.